Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage, Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.
Which one is that? That's the second time it's gone off.
They never go home, those boys.
The second captain's
world service.
Second Captain's regulars, BBC Sounds listeners, you're all very welcome to a special crossover podcast with just two episodes remaining of Where is George Gibney? Today we go deep, deep into this remarkable investigative series. Owen here with Murph, how are you?
Hey Owen, how's it going?
I say I'm here with you guys. We're not physically together, we are all still recording remotely. But Murph, I do picture you talking to us with your life-size Terry Wogan poster peering down at you from your bedroom wall as we continue a long and proud lineage of Irish broadcasters appearing on the BBC. Are you excited about this crossover pod?
Yeah, Owen, when you look back through the history of great British-Irish cultural collaborations, I mean, you're talking about Daniel Day-Lewis, John Boorman, The Pogues, Super Vet, Keith Duffy on Coronation Street. I mean, this is a tradition that stretches back generations. On, I'm just happy that we're able to play our part.
Keith Duffy, the best damn barman the Rovers Return ever saw. Was he a barman? I'm pretty sure he was a barman in the Rovers Return.
I'm sure.
I'd kind of stopped watching Coronation Street by then.
I was just delighted for him on a personal level that he got the role. I have to say, I didn't keep up to date with every, the ebb and flow of his entire character arc.
Mark Horgan and Kieran Cassidy are going to be on today to answer some of my questions and some of your questions that have been emailed in about the series so far. I can confirm that Mark and Cass will not be conducting the interview from inside an SUV somewhere along a roadside in suburban Florida, where they do appear to have spent much of their lives in the last couple of years. I get the sense there was only so much longer they could have handled that before completely losing their mind. They sound close to breaking point there.
Getting that excited about my Sharona is a sure sign, I think, that you're coming apart at the seams.
Before jumping ahead too quickly, I'm assuming a certain amount of knowledge here of what this series is all about. If you haven't heard it yet and you've just stumbled upon today's pod, it does make sense to go and listen to the 8 episodes so far, because there will be spoilers in this pod today. George Gibney, to give you the background, was a renowned Irish swimming coach who was charged with multiple counts of child sexual abuse but never stood trial and left the country after the legal case against him collapsed in 1993. In Where is George Gibney, Mark and Cass, they give some of Gibney's survivors the chance to tell their stories. They discover how Gibney managed to build a new life for himself. He went over to the UK, first of all, and then America. And also, there's a lot of new information about what kind of a life he lives today. And eventually, the patience of the guys in Florida is rewarded when they confront Gibney himself about his past. Here's just a... This is from the most recent episode. It's probably sitting in your head if you even start thinking about this series. But just, this is a reminder of this unbelievably intense scene when Mark came face to face with George Gibney, who goes by John these days. This is from episode 8.
Yeah. Take an L deep breath there. Get it into you. This is good and this is meant to happen, okay?
Yeah.
It's perfect timing.
Then George Gibney walks out of the store.
Okay, we're on. You ready?
Mm-hmm.
Give me 1 second.
Gibney and his housemate are walking back to their car.
Okay, one second. I'm gonna walk towards him now, okay?
Mm-hmm. I walk towards him alone, with my interview request in my hand.
Excuse me, John. Hi, John. Can I give you this, please? My name's Mark Horgan. I'm a journalist with the BBC. I'm recording audio at the moment. This is a request for an interview.
Gibney won't take my envelope. His housemate says, forget it, forget it.
We're going to be broadcasting a documentary series, a podcast series based on your life and the allegations against you. And we'd really like for you to be able to tell your side of the story.
Gibney is thrown. He's panicking. He staggers away from his own car. He's momentarily dazed. He's wandering in a circle.
Do you have anything to say?
It's a strange sight.
You've been quiet for about 25 years, George. I think the survivors deserve for it to hear your voice.
His housemate gets into their car and starts the engine. Gibney cautiously walks back past me, not once looking me in the eye.
We're going to FedEx this over to you.
He gets in, and they drive off suddenly. George Gibney says nothing. He's mute throughout the entire encounter. It's like an involuntary reaction. When you call out his name, he doesn't say hello or greet you. George Gibney's natural reaction when approached is to say absolutely nothing. A strategy of literal silence.
Ah, man, I cannot remember ever feeling as tense as I did listening to that scene. Listening to anything, really. It was just from the moment that Cass is willing Mark to take a deep breath and just go and do this, to right through the questioning. I'm amazed how focused Mark remained in the questions. He was still remembering the victims. You know, it's like you've been quiet for 25 years. The survivors deserve to hear your voice, which I think is what this series is all about. But it was just such an extraordinary couple of minutes.
Yeah. And having known Mark and Cass for like 17 years, it was just a mad thing for me to hear the pair of them just like Cass just being a mate to Mark at that precise moment. It was just kind of blew my mind a small bit, to be honest.
The thing about Gibney being completely silent there, not giving, and I do want to ask Mark about this, if he's disappointed that he didn't get any words from me, certainly in the immediate aftermath when he was thrashing it out with Cass in the car. He said he wanted to hear the man speak and account for himself to a certain extent that the survivors deserve to hear from him. It was so powerful nonetheless, I thought, the fact that he didn't speak, and particularly when juxtaposed with all the interviews that he gave over the years. I didn't realise that he was, because I would have been, say, 13 in 1993, so I can't say I was following the swimming scene particularly closely in the late 80s and early 90s. I didn't realise how big of a sort of a star Gibney was and how many constant interviews he was doing. But I want to get a bit more praise out of the way before the lads come in, so as not to embarrass them. And one of the most interesting things I heard said about this whole thing was from Gary O'Toole, who's one of the big heroes in the series. He's a world-class swimmer, he was at the time, who exposed what Gibney had done to others. And this is what he says in an interview with Paul Kimmage in the Sunday Independent. I think the podcast done a wonderful job of humanizing the whole thing. When the story was published in the Sunday Tribune, all of the victims were anonymous and their identities were protected. It was the Tribune that initially printed the story about Gibney all those years ago. They were vacuum sealed, hermetically sealed, and served up to the public in a way that was almost sterile and surgical. What Mark Horgan has done is a little different. It's not victim X, victim Y, victim Z. It's Patricia Carney, it's Bear Carley, it's Chalky White. He's reminding us these are people, not just letters of the alphabet, which I thought, Murph, was particularly powerful and is the one thing that we shouldn't forget when listening back to these episodes and when looking forward to the last two episodes, that these real people who've had real life effects and have their own lives are what it's all about, really.
Absolutely. You know, and that it's been the recurring theme of all of the brilliant reviews that the podcast has gotten, that it centers the survivors in a way that actually not a lot of journalism does. You know, that if you're talking about serial killers or you're talking about whatever it is, it's about the person, the monster who committed the crimes, not the people who survived them or the people who, you know, fell victim to it. And that, I think, is kind of the big thing about this podcast, that, you know, there's no, you're left in no doubt about who the center of this story is. And for all the title, it's not George Gibney. It is actually the victims and people like Gary O'Toole who did so much to expose them.
We can now chat to Mark Horgan and Kieran Cassidy, producers of Where is George Gibney? Mark, how are you?
Hi, Owen. How are you doing?
Oh, we're okay. Cass, how are you?
Good, good. Very good. Thanks for having us.
I think the most important question first up is, how is the personal relationship between you guys after all those long, long, long days stuck in the car?
Yeah, well, maybe before I talk about the personal relationship between Cass and myself, I just want to touch on the personal relationship between myself and you two guys, because it feels really strange being actually nervous about being interviewed by your friend Kieran Murphy and your friend Owen McDevitt on what is essentially our own podcast.
Yeah, but also
I do think that it's a great opportunity because I'm getting to speak to the new Terry Wogan and the new Keith Duffy. As far as Cass and I think we're okay, aren't we?
Yeah, I think we probably could tell people the secret about what happened after all the car activity, which was that all the tension, all the, you know, work stress that was going on, we went and we played crazy golf. That's how we finished off the shoot.
Oh, really?
Yes. So we were driving by some crazy golf ranch in the middle of Orlando. And I think then we worked every night over a crazy golf session.
Now, what I will say is Cass's sense of direction is really awful. So there were a couple of periods of time where he was on the map duty and I was driving the car and he was identifying where we were going and was forgetting where we were going quite a few times in the same place. And I do recall losing the rag with him. And that was quite early on.
I would like to say, okay, also, I was having trouble, okay? I'm just going to say this, put this out there. The first day or two, I couldn't get in and out of my car door, right? We had this rental car. And Mark, every time, was lambasting me, telling me, what kind of an idiot am I that I can't open the door? And you were the smartest dumb man I know, right? And then we turned out the door was defective. Poor innocent Cass. Defective, yeah. It wasn't working properly and we had to trade it in. But yeah, no, there was a couple of moments. Like, now I do admit my navigation needs a bit of work to be done.
I better stop with this line of questioning, I think, because there are two more episodes to be put out there. I need this working relationship to last at least a few more weeks, and then you can.
It's fraying
never talk
as this interview
again.
Goes on. That would be unfortunate if we were the cause of 9 and 10 never appearing.
You've teed up this question from Kira King of 2FM fame nicely, Mark. What was going inside Mark's head as he waited in the parking lot before confronting Gibney? How did he handle himself? I would have personally blown it, says Kira.
There were a lot of things going through my head, to be honest. The first thing really when we pulled up was a sense of relief that we had this opportunity that we thought was blown, and that we didn't act quick enough to go and speak to him. Both of Cass and I thought that the opportunity was gone and that last day it wasn't going to happen for us, because there were no signs of it in the previous 2 days. So the first feeling was of relief. And then very quickly, as everybody would have heard on the podcast, it was severe fear and terror that I was going to mess it up. So I was really, really nervous. And I think it was a sense that, right, this is the one chance to talk to him. I had very specific kind of guidelines that I had to follow from the BBC to do with kind of legals and privacy and all those types of things. But also I did kind of feel, even at that point when we were quite early in the process of everything to recording, that this is a moment that people will be listening to, and that the people that I've spoken to and who were survivors of Gibney, that, you know, in some way, not to be too dramatic about it, but you're kind of representing them in some way when you're approaching him. So there was lots of different things, but as people would have heard, it was severe nerves and just trying to calm down and take deep breaths and get my heart rate down was the main thing.
Obviously, Cass, you stepped in that moment with a few words, just say a couple of deep breaths, etc. We referenced it already at the start of the show. Could you see Mark at that stage? Were you in? You had a visual of Mark, and could you sense at that moment that Mark was feeling pretty nervous, or was it just the audio?
I think what happened when you're doing all of these recordings and what is that you're kind of sitting there waiting for somebody to come out of their house, and you're going to follow them, but you don't know where they're going, and we could only follow them if we were going somewhere public. So everything gets kind of really heightened, and everything's so kind of anxious and kind of rolling. So you could feel that, like, we didn't know if we were going to get him those last couple of days. Then all of a sudden he comes out. And for us, we'd been there for so long that he went a route that we'd never gone before that day. So that was also new. And, you know, so we're like all in this kind of like, where are we going? And like when you listen to tape, we say public. And that's the first thing that we say. But it's just like he could have gone somewhere and we may not have been able to go and approach him, you know. So it had to be somewhere that it was a public space that we could talk to him. So when we arrived up there, I think what happens is that I think all I was doing with Mark was that because we nearly the car had gone up in the curb and we'd arrived down and we were getting, you know, all our equipment. I think it was just taking a second and just pausing. Like we had it. And I think it was just trying to find in a moment before all of that, because it just felt fairly kind of frenzied. And it always is. But I think that it was just that moment of pausing it for a couple of seconds and then getting ourselves ready for when he comes out of it.
Yeah. And actually, you know, I kind of, when I listened back to that, I found it quite embarrassing. And
really?
Yeah, because like, you know, obviously, as you guys know, this isn't my background in doing this. So, you know, the levels of nerves probably wouldn't be experienced by somebody who's a long-term investigative journalist or something like that, you know. So like, my background's in sport, and this was something that's completely out of the norm for me. And I just kind of thought that, you know, one, was it like, it's kind of, it, maybe it's like a little bit unprofessional or something, you know, but also that it's kind of, you know, I did require calming down at that point. So, you know, it was anyway, everyone that who listened to it was no, to like cop on, that stays in.
No, I liked it. I think what's interesting is, if, from the point of view, you said that was quite early on in the recording process. So you obviously wanted to go over and try and get Gibney, try to get him on tape and try to confront him as early in the process as possible. But, you know, by the time it's played, it's later on in the series and people have listened to 7 episodes by then. And I got the sense by then, like, again, I am biased, but I was behind you. I was essentially, you know, almost felt like I was cheering you on, but talking to other people, they were in the same thing. So I think people felt that with you a little bit. You almost feel nervous as a listener as to how is this going to play out? And I mean, how it played out was extraordinary. I don't know if you can add anything now to what you've already put on your description of his reaction, but what did he look like? What was his facial reaction when you tried to hand him the letter and tried to get him to speak?
Well, so I think we explained this as much as we could on the episode itself. But so what happened was, we parked up beside his car, and what I wanted to do was leave like a good space between myself and the two men, one of them being Gibney, of course. So when I walk out and go to confront him, I suppose, that he's kind of seen this figure walking towards him for like 50, 75 meters, you know. So it's not like what's kind of traditionally done, which is you jump out with your microphone, you put it in front of somebody's face and the camera crews pop in soon afterwards. And then you're oftentimes, you would have seen them in, you know, lots of big investigative television shows where it's, you know, you're just kind of shouting the charges at him. But what we wanted to do was to try and engineer the situation so it would limit the shock that the two of them would get. And then it would also kind of maximize the opportunity for us to get them to talk, or to get Gibney to talk. So when I approached him, he had seen me for a long time in advance. You know, it wasn't when I jumped up and said, "Excuse me, John," he had seen me for a good few meters in advance of that. And the two of them were looking at me. I was trying to just, you know, bring down the tension from their perspective. His reaction was like, it was confusion for a split second. And then, like we mentioned the podcast, it was fear and it was shock. And I think, you know, that was a really quite surprising moment for me as well, because there was no surprise that he didn't say anything, you know, even if I did expect there to be some sort of utterance and I expected him to respond in some way, even if it's to say I've nothing to say. But just to see somebody react in that way where he was completely lost where he was going, it's almost like he lost his mind for a second and then wandered off in the opposite direction. You know, you're not sure what to do in that situation then as well, apart from just to stay talking to him or to stay on him and to keep asking the questions. But it was interesting. The person that he was with was actually very composed and walked to the car. Gibney was the exact opposite of that. So I don't really know how to describe it apart from somebody who's just lost their mind for a second and then is trying to get it back, but then realizes that the only way they can get out of this situation is to walk back past me, do you know? So yeah, that was it.
Fergal Burke asked, "Were you disappointed he didn't speak? What had you expected him to say or do? You must have felt like telling him what you thought of him." So I guess it's the first one there. Like and this is something you trashed out. I was quite surprised with how clear-eyed both of you were in discussing what had just happened in the car afterwards. you were teasing this out at the time, but all this time later, it's a good question that Fergal asks. At this point, were you disappointed he didn't speak and you didn't get his voice on tape?
Yeah, I was really disappointed. But it's kind of going back to what we said before. I was, at that point, I was also really happy just as a journalist that we got the interaction on tape, you know, even if there was very little in the interaction coming from him. So it was, there was a little bit of that, but like Cass, you know, he did really well at that point because he went and put a mic in front of me then. And I didn't know we were going to start talking then at that point. We were just recording the interaction, you know, so Cass just started talking to me and I was pretty shook. But yeah, I was really disappointed. But like I said, we weren't surprised because, you know, people will remember from episode 7 that when Peter Banks said, "I've heard these rumors back in Ireland about what's been going on," he said nothing. And there's loads of different instances where he's been confronted and he says nothing. And these, often we can't broadcast all of these, but there could be interactions in the US when he's confronted, or they're certainly interactions, you know, at different times from survivors of his. So the idea that he wasn't going to speak was the most likely, or, you know, the outcome that he wasn't going to speak was the most likely. But no, I was disappointed. And I think at that point, sorry if I'm blabbing on too long here about this own, but it was what just that moment, I thought about it an awful lot since, you know, and what I've thought about is the fact that I hadn't spoken to so many of the survivors. I hadn't spoken to Trish, Burr or Chalky yet at that point, or interviewed them. And once you're on that point of the journey with everybody else and you've heard all their stories, I'm actually really glad that I didn't have all that baggage with me, if that's the right word. I don't mean that in any disrespectful way, because they're some of the best people I've ever met in my life, and they're absolutely brilliant, and they're also listening to this, I'm sure, as well. But I think that, you know, I'd be so close to it and close to those people that I think I would have found it more difficult to hold it together if I had have approached them with all that with me, you know. So in some ways, it's a bit of a blessing that the part of our production plan to make sure he wasn't alerted to the production was to speak to him first.
Yeah. And Cass, you wanted to come in there. You obviously felt there was the moment was right there to keep the microphone rolling and keep talking, that there was plenty you can get out of that moment without actually hearing his voice.
Yeah. Well, see, the thing about it was I was hidden behind like a van. So we had radio mics and then I had a stereo mic. So like for me, what was quite haunting about it was I didn't see a lot of it. So that I could hear, but I couldn't hear anything. Like, as in, I didn't hear any voice. I could hear Mark, but there was this silence coming back. And it was only like where I was down making sure that I was getting all the recordings. And I could see then at the corner of my George Gibney, like I was not out of the way, but I was making sure that they wouldn't see me. So I was up near our car and their car was down there. And then all of a sudden, George Gibney came up around where we were. And it was just very strange where he arrived in my vision and he went back. And like what I felt about it afterwards when Mark was saying about the disappointment, like I felt though that there was something very conscious in what had happened, and there was a moment in that, like if he'd have said no comment and get out of my way and all of that, it would have been strange, but it's almost like it's in the script about that there was something. It wasn't an accident that he didn't say anything. This is what he does now, that where if he sees anybody or if anybody approaches or anything like that, he actually says nothing at all. And for somebody...
Yeah, and as you're saying, this is the man that you couldn't shut up for many years, and now he's saying nothing at all.
So yeah, I found that really haunting in that moment. And so that's probably why I went down to talk to Mark about it, because in the actual nothingness, there was actually something quite, like I felt quite profound about it, in the sense that he, like when, like for the first time, I'd say in years, that somebody had approached him, somebody had talked to him, a stranger approaches him, he knew straight away. And like, you know, as Mark was detailing, this happens over and over and over again. And we've heard it from other people. So I think in that moment where literally he didn't say something, I think it was worth us then just talking about what had happened. And I think like the first thing that really struck me was him trailing off. Like that he did kind of short circuit, like he did kind of get him lost for a second, but he still managed, even in all of that, not to say anything. Like he still had that kind of preservation instinct concerning what was going on, even though like he was kind of flapping a bit. And then I think the second thing for us was just then to be able to, and I was just thinking, even I didn't even know if we were going to be, you know, you like broadcasting it, but it was just for us journalistically to get our points in about what had just happened and how it had happened, and because it's very quick and then it was gone.
It's not just about, I mean, this podcast is not just about George Gibney. It's about his victims, his survivors. And I think it does an unbelievable job of personalizing those people, of As Gary O'Toole put it, I mentioned it earlier on, of making these into essentially real life human beings, not just victim X or victim Y as they were three decades ago. On that, Mark, you asked yourself a question in an Irish Times piece you wrote. You said, is it the right thing to do? Is it the right thing to do to ask these people to trust me to tell their story and to ask them to talk about details that are, you know, all this time later still are not easy things to talk about? What is the answer to that question now? Do you feel like it has been the right thing to do?
I think the answer to that question can be varied, and that it's still, depending on the person that you speak to, mightn't be the right thing for them. I think that we've been really lucky with this production that it has been the right thing for everybody that we've spoken to. And I can kind of categorically say that because I've spoken to, you know, Trish and Burr and Chalky and to Laura and the family of Susan, and they're all very clear in that this is the right thing for them and that they've found it to be a positive process. And I think that has always been the biggest concern of mine from the very start. And that's also been the most rewarding thing, for sure. You know, that's been by far the most rewarding thing. So I'm sure lots of people will be asking about, you know, whether the survivors will ever get justice for this case, you know, whether Gibney will ever be tried, et cetera, et cetera. But that's never been our job, you know. That's never been the kind of goal for us from the start. The goal of mine and Cass's from the start was to tell the stories of these people and to hopefully tell them in a way that will represent them correctly and also, you know, gives them a voice and gets the truth out there. And that's what the key thing's been from the start. And thanks to everyone who's listened to the podcast and everyone who's listening at the moment, because just the reaction online has been phenomenal, and the kind of strength and warmth and support for these people has like been really amazing. And the solidarity, and I hope when they have listened to the show and they heard the accounts of the people that I just mentioned, that they recognize, you know, the strength that those people have. And maybe that also gives other people who have been affected in some way strength to talk about it or to come forward if they so wish, or to feel that they're represented in a way that's also, you know, in some way positive. I know that sounds strange, but you know the point I'm trying to get at.
Hmm.
You've obviously gotten very, very fond of the people that you've focused on in the podcast. I mean, how do you build a relationship like that with people that you've never met up until the last 2 years?
I don't think there's like a proper mechanics for it, Murph, that I'd be comfortable about talking about steps or anything like that. You know, I think what it is.
Yeah, I don't mean that it's like I know what you mean. It's not like it's like a transactional thing. Here's how I become friends with people. Like I suppose what I'm asking more so is just that relationship. Those relationships seem so true when listening to the podcast.
It's true because it's the truth. I think that's the key thing, and that you're just be honest to everybody. Be completely honest. You know, I think everybody they spoke to realized that I'll do my best on it. You know, the Cass and I didn't know how this thing was going to turn out. We didn't know whether it was going to be any good. And in December of last year, we thought it was probably going to be quite bad, and things weren't going the way we wanted it to go. You know, so like, the idea of building a relationship is just to be honest and to tell the truth about what was going on, and hopefully that they would recognize that you're going to do what you say you're going to do. And that also time is the big thing. Like, you just have to give this project so much time, you know, because it's not something that you can rush anyone into talking about, you know, and it just has to be really respectful and slow and giving people as much time as possible. And that's why we're really lucky with this project in lots of ways. The kind of time frame that BBC and that Second Captains have given us to actually commit a really long period of time to it, and just to be kind of respectful in how we approach it. But a key thing with the relationship was, like I said, being quite new to that whole process and trying to figure out, you know, as much as you can and get as much advice as you possibly can from people who have dealt with cases of child sexual abuse before in the past. But also, like, said this a few times before, but like, Trish and Burr were guiding me through the process at a certain point, you know, like, they also recognize that, okay, you know, this guy is in the deep end here, and he's committed a whole lot of time to this. And it definitely got to the point where they were like, okay, listen, I want to make sure this fella's okay. Do you know what I mean? So that's kind of just another example of the type of people they are. But they were at a certain point concerned about how I was, as opposed to the other way around.
How were you on this? Gary O'Toole wrote about how he wasn't sure if you realised the extent of the Pandora's box you're opening and essentially about the amount of misery that was in there and the effect it would have on you. Mm. Has it had a deeper effect than you might have imagined even at the beginning?
And there were a few times as well, I know, that you would have called me and we would have gone for a pint, and it would have seemed like there was a lot of pressure on you, that like, and you know, we might not have talked about the ins and outs of what exactly had happened that had given you a bad day, but I certainly recall a number of times where you just really, really needed to not think about this for an hour.
Yeah, and I think probably that's what leads back to the confrontation of Gibney being a positive thing, because it was so early. Yeah, I think Cass and I would have both experienced this. I think it was a little bit more difficult for, I don't mean to say this because this sounds awful, but a little bit more difficult for me, because I'd met all the survivors and I was the one that did all those interviews. And it's a weird process. To be honest, I did find parts of it really, really upsetting, deeply upsetting, and upsetting post interviews with people. And it was the kind of to the forefront of my mind was whether I, you know, we were going to be able to do a good enough job after what I just heard, you know, and that we had, you know, a duty to do a good job when people had opened up like that. Stories of the most difficult things that have ever happened to them in their lives. So yeah, it's funny. I definitely, and you know, my girlfriend will definitely would have kind of felt it as well, but it was difficult for you not to be thinking about the project all the time, like all the time, weekends, you know, when you finish your working day. There's periods where you couldn't get it out of your head because we'd committed to it and we had to do it right. So that's why I gave you calls for those pints, Murph.
That does sound like at least you have your uses, Murph.
I've never felt more wanted in the company, Yod.
We might ask, I think different episodes probably affected people in different ways. Obviously, confronting Gibney is something that I'll never forget, listening to that for the first time. Another one was the story, the episode around Susan, not her real name, but this was the swimmer whose just life was absolutely destroyed. Obviously, her sporting dreams taken away, but this is the girl who was raped by George Gibney in Florida in a hotel room. And you don't speak to Susan because she's in a mental health facility, possibly for the rest of her life, her family fear. But you do speak to her sister, Laura. And this is Laura talking a bit about the aftermath of what happened in Florida.
When she came back from Florida, we did the Belfast thing. And then I don't know exactly the time frame, but then she threw herself down the stairs and became injured. And that's when she stopped swimming then. My mum said, like, he took away her dream of qualifying for the Olympics, because that was her dream. So she stopped then, left swimming off completely. I don't remember it, but my mum obviously remembers it very clearly. Mm-hmm. And she said, yeah, that was the kind of the end of it then. That was the end of her swimming. And then that's when everything went just spiraled.
Yeah, just I don't know what you felt, Cass, the kind of reaction you were getting to different stories through the podcast. And I'm not trying to pit one against the other necessarily as being more heartbreaking, but there was just something about that really made people angry, made me angry listening to it, that he destroyed this girl's life and she didn't get it. She wasn't able to rebuild it, and her life is still has essentially been destroyed. Everything has been taken away from her because of something this man did years ago.
Yeah, like I think when we were kind of doing out the episodes and kind of trying to structure it, I think that we just were struck by the fact that Chalky still lives in Florida, but this event happened in Tampa, Florida, and George Gibney Lowe lives there. So I think, like, although we're telling Susan's story in that episode, you're also consciously, everybody's aware that this is where this guy is now living free. And it's just such a strange juxtaposition of the story that I think it just gives it this renewed emotional depth. And I think like I think what I noticed was it was kind of amazing for me to be part of this, just to see the reaction on Thursday mornings. Mm. So it started kind of building up, and where you'd see the people were really listening to it. And what happens is, like, I've been doing like radio docs for about 10, 12 years. And I definitely think that the thing that struck me about it was that I would have maybe 10 years ago thought, would people engage with a stories like this? Would people be willing to spend time? Would be people be saying, maybe not, I don't want to listen to this? But the actual engagement, the empathy, the conversation, I think, like, I don't think it would have happened 10 years ago. And it was really, really powerful to see people really engage with episode 2, because I just saw people talking with Trish and Bear online, and I just thought that was incredible. And I just saw this thing. I've seen, you know, other people, like, and then with episode 6, I saw, you know, people own that story and feel very proud about the way it was presented. But also I saw people react with that and kind of, in a way, and engage with the story, which I don't know would have happened years ago. And I don't know whether that's like something due to society with Me Too now and how stories are treated. Because I think in Justine's book, this is Justine McCarthy, unbelievably incredible journalist.
Deep Deception is the book. Yeah.
She like detailed that like child sex abuse crimes are the one crime where an editor in a newspaper would turn around and say, you know, we don't want any of the detail, or we don't want any of the, you know, the thing. And they try and minimize it. And it's kind of like, and they don't want these stories to be kind of the light shone on them because they feel it's off-putting or something like that. While with this series, like, the level of engagement from the audience really struck me and been really, really positive.
I think also just with that episode, that is a point that was really crucial there, is that obviously there's the survivors of Gibney's abuse, and, you know, you outline the effects, the lasting effects that his abuse has had on these people, and people who were kids in the, as far back as the 1960s. But also the lasting effects that they has on survivors' families is incredible, you know, and and they're absolutely are victims of George Gibney's as well. So I think that was important at some point during the podcast series that we talk about dads who are outside swimming pools at 6 a.m, leaving their kids off and sleeping in the car while their kids train. And I think it was important to talk about little sisters who, you know, lost their older sisters who they absolutely love and still love today, and think about when they're every day when they're out in a run. You know, it's like these effects are lasting, they're forever. And it's not just the survivors of his abuse, the direct survivors who face the consequences of what he did.
Kevin Keneally sent an email. Mark seems like a very affable guy who probably gets on with most people he meets.
Thank you, Kevin.
Which is mostly true, Kevin. Yep,
it can sometimes be tough for someone. And his terrible directions.
Just don't put a map in anyone's hands. Yeah,
it can sometimes be tough for someone that's normally on good terms with everyone to put them under pressure. Did he find it difficult to switch into that mode of asking tough questions and putting people in uncomfortable or tough spots? So I'm going to take that question to mean the interviews with the likes of John Mullins, who posted bail for Gibney, revealed to you during an interview that he posted bail for Gibney at the time, and Peter Banks, those sort of challenging interviews, in the sense that you were interviewing people who had not been heard really on this before. I mean, Banks is a former assistant. We'll play this because I think this illustrates what Kevin's emailing about. Banks is a former assistant of Gibney's in Ireland. He went over to the US, became a Hall of Fame coach there, and a really world-renowned coach. You got him to talk about all this for the first time, and you asked him a very specific question, whether it was him who had written the job offer that accompanied Gibney's US visa application in the early 90s. This is his answer.
It doesn't ring a bell with me. It doesn't say, oh yes, I remember doing that. He had asked me to do that. I don't ever.
But he might have.
He might have. Yeah, of course. He could have.
It is unusual that you don't remember whether you wrote that job offer or not.
Yeah, I mean, I could have done it. I'm not saying I didn't do it. I could have done it, but it could have been in a. Yeah, he could have been over at the time in one of the training camps and said, by the way, I'm doing this. Can you write something up for me?
And you don't remember the club?
Well, the club was, I mean...
Blue Wave,
yeah. I mean, it would have been Blue Wave.
So
I mean,
you're interested in the services of...
Yeah, it would have been Blue Wave if I was going to say anything. It would have been where I was, you know?
So that's, and I mean this in the best possible sense of the word, that's kind of excruciating to listen to, that that answer. And I guess what I'm wondering, what Kevin was wondering, is do you find it difficult to be in that moment? This guy has given you his time. He's there of his own free will, but you do have to push him on these points.
No, I can't say I do find it difficult. I think that that's entirely what our jobs were in that situation. And I think that, you know, we'd done an awful lot of work before those two interviews that you talk about, on before John Mullins and Peter Banks. So I think that if I wasn't able to ask that those questions, then I'm definitely not the right person for the job. So no, absolutely not. I was quite comfortable in asking them, you know, and I thought that it was important for them to answer those questions. And I think that it's kind of interesting. I think the Peter Banks and John Mullins interviews are really interesting for a variety of reasons. And that was, like, as you say, you know, quite a excruciating moment with Peter Banks. But kind of a point that I've thought about a lot is that those two people did agree to speak to us, you know, and they did agree to go on the record about something that, you know, they would recognize that, say in John Mullins's case, he posted bail. He you know, said he posted bail for George Gibney. And he also later in that interview, he said, and I think that a lot of people kind of reacted to this, he said that he would do the same thing over again, you know, which I think is a really surprising thing for people to say. And I think that wasn't a very smart thing to say, to be honest. But I do feel that at least John spoke about that time. And I feel that there's, and from our experiences, lots of individuals who are around the Irish Amateur Swimming Association at that time, who also would have questions to answer, who wouldn't speak to us. I wouldn't go on the record. And I think as long as coaches and people that are involved are still trying to kind of hide or trying to are hoping that the subject goes away, then nobody will get any closure on this. You know, that's it's always going to be this kind of little dirty secret that happened, as opposed to dealing with it. People can often recognize that a man who manipulated so many swimmers and who acted the way he did for so many years reprehensibly was also had the ability to manipulate parents and manipulate coaches. And that it's not a black and white case of somebody supporting him at the time and then also completely changing their mind on it. I think that that's a really interesting point with this. And I think that for me, even though those individuals, in some ways, their interviews were difficult, and John Mullins faced consequences, obviously, from doing the interview with us from the board of Swim Ireland, I do feel strongly that at least they spoke to us and at least they're not hiding. But going back to the answer to your question, that's entirely our jobs. And I don't think Cass would be too impressed if I came back from those interviews and I didn't ask the questions that we had there after doing all our research.
I think it's also important because there's a big question here. As you say, John Mullins isn't the only person within the swimming community in Ireland and indeed in the UK who supported Gibney, and there seems to have been support for him both within the swimming community and outside the swimming community over the years, even after people began to find out what he had actually done. For example, you explore the Knights of Columbus in the US to quite a detailed degree. So it seems like, you know, in many ways this is a story of children being failed by adults, certainly at the time, and maybe even in the years since.
Like, I think one of the fundamental questions is, like, I think, like, sometimes people knew, like, may have had suspicions before the charges arised and they turned a blind eye. But then there was a whole array of people afterwards who, when they were aware of the 27 charges and were aware of the newspaper articles, but still helped him as well. And I think that is one of the things that we found very troubling about the whole series. Like, I think there was always a question of, did people know? How much would they be aware of? What did they know was going on at the time? Did they have suspicions? Why they didn't say anything? But like, you know, when we were looking, you know, Mark looked into some of the British coaches. Look, it was 10 years later and they were still kind of helping him out after the charges had arisen. So like, there was a very strange reaction, like, you know, even like let's say somebody bringing him up to coach people in Monaghan 6 months later or whatever. Like, it's people's reaction back in this period of time is very strange to child abuse allegations, you know, like what we might think now of those and what our reaction is.
But also, you're totally right about a time when children were failed. It's really dark enough in ways a kind of a dark period in Irish history. And the idea of children not being believed sometimes by even by parents, you know, that it's a case of the person who's in a powerful position, they're being, you know, just this kind of sense of deference. And that happens consistently in cases with the Catholic Church, that the priest is believed or they find excuses for the priest. And that's definitely the case when it comes to George Gibney, you know. And that's, it's also just the idea that we've kind of talked about a lot, but the age of imminent achievement, when kids are on the cusp of making a breakthrough in their sport, and they're entrusted into the kind of into the care of coaches who are in powerful positions, and you know, they're at their most vulnerable at that time. But yeah, a lot, it is a case of that children just being failed by people not asking questions, not acting, and not being oftentimes just not being assertive enough to actually ask questions and get stuff shut down. And that's not just a case of this case in swimming. It's a case of definitely of abuse cases and historic abuse cases in Ireland at that time.
Got one more email that came in from Kevin McInerney. He just asked, when you decided to do this podcast, did you understand it could hamper any future legal proceedings and that George Gibney may never get a fair trial in Ireland? Or did you hope that the evidence revealed would lead to new charges and a possible new trial?
There's 2 points here. So when it comes to contempt of court, Gibney's not currently charged with anything. So there's no possibility of that. The clock starts ticking on contempt of court when somebody is charged and that there's a case is ongoing. So and also the point is that in lots of the allegations that and the abuse that we detail in the podcast, Gibney, they've also been aired quite a few times in the media in Ireland. So it's not like a lot of the information is entirely new. Now, you know, the idea of hampering a trial, maybe a retrial or something like that, we'll go into this a lot more, and I, you know, don't want to spoil 9 and 10 and elements that we're going to investigate in 9 and 10, but the principle of legal certainty after a case like this means that once a court decides a particular case, like the case that happened in 93-94 in the Supreme Court, then it remains decided. Now, there's other elements that we'll look into further and investigate, but in reality, if Kevin's talking about a fair trial, which involves the former complainants in the original trial, I don't think that trial is going to happen. And if he's talking about any other instances of, you know, if other people come forward or anything like that, there's no charges against Gibney yet. So there's no fear of us being in contempt of court.
Is that the kind of stuff that you mentioned? You'll be hearing more of that in episode 9 and 10. You're still looking for people to get in touch at the usual email addresses?
Yeah, absolutely. And that's been, like I mentioned earlier on, one of the best things about putting this podcast together is that as I know Trish and Burr and Chalky wanted was to tell their stories, for them to tell their own stories, obviously, and for that then to encourage people if they're ready. And, you know, oftentimes the right thing for people who are survivors of abuse isn't to come forward and to necessarily email a podcast that's doing a piece in it. But that people know that if they contact us, it's in complete confidence. They will be entirely anonymous and it'll be done on their terms. And I think, though, that it's really just a case of the podcast helping people to feel that they're not alone, that there's some solidarity there for them, and that if the time is right for them, then we'll absolutely tell their story. So yes, where is George Gibney at bbc.co.uk? We'd love to hear from people still.
One other element that we haven't really talked about, and it's maybe something that you don't even notice is as important as it actually is, but really does make it, is the other elements, such as the music. Like, I don't know how you go and say, oh, geez, I really love the National, I think I'll just get Aaron Dessner on to do the score for this. But that all works really well. How did that all come about?
Well, you see, Owen, that's what happens when I leave Second Captains and I go and start working on a project for the BBC. I get to be friends with Aaron Dessner. So basically, Cass and myself have been hanging out a lot with Aaron. Shout out to Aaron if you're listening. Sadly, I've never communicated with Aaron Dessner.
That's how Aaron was to keep
it. I wish I had, yeah. But yeah, there's basically our executive producer is friends with Lisa Hannigan, the brilliant singer Lisa Hannigan. And initially, when we were looking for people to compose a theme tune, that we approached Lisa, because she's obviously absolutely brilliant. And she at that time had been working with Aaron Dessner and had been communicating with Aaron Dessner and got back in touch to say, listen, I think there's a piece of music that could work really well for it, and sent us over this this track, which is really, you know, it was kind of shocking when we heard it first because it works so perfectly. Yeah. It's really beautiful. And also it's, you know, Aaron Dessner of The National. So it was like, yes, please. We can definitely, if there's any way we can sort that out. Yes, please. So, yeah, we were really lucky to get that. But I think it loads of people have commented on it as well. And I think it works really well, don't you?
Yeah.
Oh, that's beautiful. Yeah. Amazing. And I mean, I know Cass is really good on the ukulele, but in the end, going with Aaron Dessner was absolutely the right decision.
I have to say, though, as well, the one thing from editing it through, the Aaron Dessner did the team tune, but the whole score was done by a guy, Michael Fleming. And he, we sent off, I think, at the very start, 3 or 4 episodes to him. And he did this incredible job because, we were editing it, and there was episodes, maybe episode 2 and 3 and 4. He just really was invested in the story. And I don't know. Anyway, he's a fair...
Yeah, the whole thing sounds amazing. Yeah, it really does. Yeah, not just the theme tune.
All right, well, Mark, I have to say, I'm still a bit put out that I wasn't invited for these pints for yourself and Murph when you needed to pick me up. It's and there's no pints for anyone at the moment, so I don't know when we'll get to do that again. But
if he wanted to talk journalism, he was going to get a call off you. If you wanted to talk about the Meath footballers, then I'm his man.
You know, Owen, aside from Michael Fleming there that Cass mentioned, I'd really like to thank a few other people as well, because, you know, Cass and I are talking now and we've done a few interviews and we kind of get tagged into the BBC tweets and the Second Captain's tweets and stuff like that. But it's also Maria Horgan, who's a co-producer in this project and did so much of the work, particularly early on, and lots of our investigation into Gibney's time in the US, and to Killian Down, who is a Second Captain's researcher, who is an absolutely brilliant guy.
Yeah.
And a brilliant young legal mind as well, who's a fact checker and researcher with us, and also Ger McDonald, and from the BBC, Dylan Haskins, just purely for being friends with Aaron Dessner. No, it's only that, but the executive producer, and Jason Phipps. But and aside from that, I have to also thank our Second Captain's members who are listening to this, because they've allowed us to pursue, along with thankfully the BBC, but allowed us to pursue a long form story like this. So thanks to everyone. And Owen, I will have a pint with you when you finally get Grunge Week over the line, because you keep backing out of it. And even I see you kind of teasing it a little bit. You tease it on the podcast. Grunge Week, for anyone who doesn't know, is one of the greatest and really shittest slots in podcast history that is on Second Captain's podcast. And Owen and I are the only ones who love it. But you keep pushing it, Owen, and you keep getting pushback.
I'm getting too much pushback. Murph, it all boils down to whether or not you recognise the artistic merit in the great musical era that was grunge. Unfortunately, my co-presenters Murph and Ken do not recognize that artistic merit. Unfortunately, it's difficult for me to deal with the hostility when I try to run this by them every year.
Cass, can you put a word in with Aaron Dessner and get him to host Grunge Week?
Is the National Grunge? I don't think it is, but we can certainly give him a shot.
Mark went nearly an entire podcast without cursing there, but then right at the end, he had to ruin all his good work.
Can't wait for the final two episodes, December 3rd, Thursday, December 3rd and December 10th. So all you two guys have to do is try and keep that working relationship going in the meantime. Thanks, Cass. Thanks, Mark. Great work.
Thanks a lot, lads.
All right, that's pretty much it for now. As you've been hearing, there are 2 more episodes still to come of Where is George Gibney? Our Second Captain's listeners, we'll chat to you guys again tomorrow. As for everybody listening on BBC Sounds, thank you so much for taking the time to do that. It was lovely talking to you. Hopefully we'll chat to you again soon. Thanks, Murph.
Thank you, Owen.
Thanks again. We'll talk to you soon.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.